I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Donald Trump campaigned on his business credentials and his promise to bring back jobs and rein in immigration. And within the first few weeks of his time in office, he signed executive orders. He's reduced regulations. He's called out a couple of companies, including Nordstrom, and instituted a temporary refugee ban. We'll be talking with Rana Farrukhar, Time Magazine business columnist, in just a couple of minutes. We'll also be talking with Shannon Coulter, co-founder of Grab Your Wallet, and that's a boycott campaign against Trump-branded products. But joining us first is Karen Kerrigan, and she's head of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council. And Karen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great. It's really great to be here, Marty. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me give out that phone number, especially to people that have a small business. We definitely want to hear from you. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Karen, what does small business, what do they want from the Trump administration?
Well, I think the President Trump, he campaigned on a range of policies that were very appealing to small businesses, fixing the tax system. Obviously, the tax system is very complicated. It's burdensome, and it hasn't been reformed for, close to 30 years. So fixing the tax reform is a big issue. And it's something that they would like to see the administration and Congress actually come through on. The other issue that we've heard a lot from our members is the issue of regulation,
right.
Regulatory burden, making sure that the process itself is one that listens to the concerns of small businesses, takes their concerns into account, and is a system that's transparent, takes costs into account, and produces smarter regulations, not necessarily more regulations that burden small businesses. The other issue that we hear is the cost of health coverage and reforms and initiatives that are going to bring more competition back to the system, lower health coverage costs. And then more broadly speaking, policies that are going to encourage stronger economic growth so that businesses are bringing in more revenues and that there's sustained economic growth for the future. So those are sort of some of the key issues.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot on the agenda.
There's more, Marty. I figure. Well, let me take apart some of the ones that you just mentioned in terms of regulations. And, of course, there are thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of regulations. Thinking about small business, what a person with, let's say, 10, 20, 30 employees, broadly speaking, what is it that they want?
Well, I think that to ensure that the system, again, it's not just, there are federal regulations, but there's a lot at the state and local level as well.
Yes, there are.
The things that really are the regulations that a small business owner faces, once at the startup phase. But at the federal level, rules that are going to essentially create a more business-friendly environment. I mean, for example, there have been rules that have been passed at the federal level. For example, if you look at, the overtime rule that was passed, that's sort of a one-size-fits-all policy, and small business owners are very concerned that raising that threshold didn't take into account, various local and state labor market conditions or maybe the cost of living in areas. There's another rule called the joint employer regulation that would, if you're a small business working for a big business, for example, that really sort of takes away the traditional definition of direct and immediate control to indirect control, where essentially if you're a business and there's a certain labor violation against your business, that both the business would be held accountable for that. Those type of issues that business owners want, the regulatory agencies to take a more common sense approach to. The other big thing is looking back. You know what?
Let me just stop you there, only because and a lot of this I realize is complicated. But this overtime rule. Now they raised the level of where someone would be required to pay overtime from $23,000 to $47,000. Do small business people, do they not want to pay overtime for people who are working more than 40 hours, or is it that the government is requiring them to do that?
You know, I think it was, I mean, for our members, it was just that the doubling of the threshold and that sort of going, really, I mean, just that immediate jump, you know, from 26 to 47,000. I mean, some of them, particularly, you know, in certain areas of the country, just that was sort of an unrealistic wage rate, you know, if you will, you know, based on their cost of living. So it was just a huge jump, an immediate jump, you know, in that threshold, that it was, you know, quite shocking, you know, for many of our members and a lot of small business owners. I mean, they were, there are other proposals on the table, things that we're talking with, for example, the Labor Department about in terms of phasing in that over a number of years. But just that sort of immediate jump, you know, of that threshold was something that many of our members really could not, you know, withstand as a business, particularly, again, given the fact that their businesses weren't growing, they don't have the revenues to support that growth. And so a lot of them were sort of had to change around their business models. I mean, moving, you know, full-time people to part-time. And so there was a lot of disruption, if you will, for business owners.
What about things like paid sick leave and maternity and paternity leave? How does small business, and I realize small business covers a lot of different kinds of businesses, but broadly speaking, what's the perspective on that?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, you know, how the government defines small business and sort of what a business, you know, a really small business with 5 to 10 employees is quite different. I think from a small business perspective, you know, when there are mandates like this that either come from the state, you know, or at the federal level, I think the one-size-fits-all, you know, approach is and the mandate that says they have to do this is what really gets them in terms of being able to work out those types of arrangements individually, you know, with their employee. So, the mandate or the rule itself may be something, again, that really doesn't fit the business model, you know, of specific businesses, or something that they just, you know, can't afford. It's like, well, look, I can work this out individually, you know, with my employees. Why is the government telling me, you know, what to do?
Well, and I'm sure there are some very enlightened employers that want to make sure that their employees come to work healthy and are able to take care of sick children, sick family members. But there are, of course, employers that don't do that. And that, of course, leaves the worker kind of high and dry.
You know, it does. And, you know, from our perspective, and again, I'm talking for my members that we deal with, a lot of them, you know, and I would say most of them are very sensitive to this, and they want to keep their employees. You know, replacing employees is a very expensive proposition, and they tend to treat their employees very well. But, you know, their employers like that. I mean, there is, you know, the check of the marketplace. If they're, you know, they're going to have continual turnover or people leaving their businesses, that's not good for their business, and they're not going to, you know, survive without having that type of turnover. But I understand what you're saying in terms of not being fair to the, you know, this not being fair to the employee. But in, like I said, with our membership and our members, I mean, they are very sensitive to this, I think, particularly given because they want to keep and retain the good quality employees that they have.
You mentioned growth, and of course, everyone is in favor of that. My understanding of our large and complicated economy is that growth really depends on consumer spending, that you want people with money, spending money, buying products at small businesses. How much do you think this administration and even your organization wants to make sure that consumers have the wherewithal in order to be such an important player in our economy?
Well, you're right. I mean, and that, you know, for small businesses and our members, you know, over the past 8 to 10 years, and, you know, there was the, you know, the Great Recession, you know, followed by the financial crisis, the recession, and then generally speaking, a very weak economy. And that has, you know, been the issue, is sort of slow growth in the economy, you know, consumers being very reserved, obviously making business owners very reserved about hiring and investing in their businesses. And so we need, you know, stronger growth in the economy, and we need, consumers feeling confident, about where the economy is going. But we also need wage growth in the economy, right? We need, you know, for people to be making more money. And that all depends on, you know, healthy businesses and businesses growing, investing more, being confident, you know, seeing sustainable growth in the economy, you know, that leads to that wage growth, that leads to that confidence that will have consumers, you know, buying more and spending more, you know, particularly at small businesses. So, you know, that is sort of the overriding issue. And, you know, what this administration has to address, and I think what the last administration, was addressing too, albeit the economy was growing slowly, and we had quarters of very strong growth, 3.5% growth, and then we had quarters where there's less than 1% growth. And, you know, for our members and for small businesses, they, we're not seeing that traction. You know, we're not seeing that long-term traction and sustainability in the economy. And that, I think that's an issue that this administration really has to deal with. And for us, it all goes back to small business policy and making sure that small policies that are going to encourage small business growth and actually encouraging more people to start businesses, because that's been a real problem, is going to lead to that stronger and sustainable growth over the long term.
Linda McMahon is now the head of the Small Business Administration. Are you happy about that, and what do you want her to do?
You know, it's very interesting because, we're very optimistic about her leadership, given that she has sort of been there in terms of, you know, taking a startup, a small regional business with less than 15 employees. I'm talking about the World Wrestling Entertainment business.
That's right.
You know, her business, and taking that to a very strong global brand with over 800 employees. I was very impressed by her testimony before the Senate Small Business Committee, you know, talking about sort of what it took to grow that business in terms of, you know, the worries that she had, in terms of paying employees, in terms of the challenges that come with scaling a business, access to capital, competing in the global marketplace, having to deal with intellectual property issues. I mean, all those types of things that many businesses have to deal with. So, you know, we are, and beyond just her role at World Wrestling Entertainment, founder and CEO, she's also very involved with women's leadership and women's entrepreneurship, and feels very strongly about that. So we're encouraged by that, and again, being able to run a major operation like she has, she'll be able to take those skills to run a major, you know, organization, the SBA.
Well, Karen, only because they're playing my song, I have to say goodbye to you. They're playing my song. Karen Kerrigan, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You bet. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. President and CEO of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Trump added two more members to his administration this week, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Linda McMahon to head up the Small Business Administration. His nominee for Labor Secretary Andrew Puzder could face a fight later this week because of the practices at his fast food chain restaurants and his undocumented housekeeper. Wall Street seems to be wild about President Trump, with the stock market breaking records, enthused by Trump's call for reducing the business tax rate and getting rid of regulations. But it hasn't all been smooth sailing. A number of business executives criticized the White House refugee ban, and some have been called out by the president, including Nordstrom, for dropping his daughter's clothing line. We asked Rana Faruhar to join us. She is business columnist at Time Magazine, also CNN's global economic analyst. Wrote a book last year, in fact, was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book called Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Rana Faruhar, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Well, it has been a kind of a whirlwind of signings and controversy. Is that good for business?
You know, there's sort of two phenomena happening here with the Trump administration and business. You know, markets are at near record highs, and a lot of people say, why is that? I mean, just, you know, to step back for a minute and look at the broader picture, the huge scandal with the administration and Russia breaking right now, you know, a lot of geopolitical turmoil, uncertainty about what this administration is going to do. How could that possibly be good for business, people might ask? Well, you know, you look at the markets, they're at record highs. What they're responding to is really two things. One is the possibility of tax cuts, which is kind of the one thing so far that the Trump administration and congressional Republicans really seem to be somewhat in agreement on. You know, the details of what's going to get through and how are up for grabs. But basically, the Trump administration and Republicans want to see corporate tax cuts. They'd like to see some sort of repatriation for cash that's being held abroad. Big companies keep a lot of money in overseas tax havens. They'd like to bring that back to the U.S. and pay lower rates on it. That will probably get through. And the markets love that. You know, what's not to like? More money for corporations. But when you look at a deeper level, you know, what's really happening on Main Street, what's happening in the real economy, I think the picture's, you know, much more mixed and really responding more to basics in the economy that the president can't really control.
Well, let me pick up on several things. And assuming these tax cuts go through and assuming some of this money is brought back from overseas, what does the stock market, what does Wall Street do with all that extra money? Do they invest it in jobs and creating companies that hire people, or will they just keep the money and get even richer?
Probably the latter.
You think so?
Actually, I think so. And actually, there's a factual basis for that opinion, which is that we had a tax repatriation in 2004. Companies were allowed to bring overseas cash held in offshore havens back to the U.S. at a lower corporate tax rate. The vast majority of that money, and it was significant, hundreds of millions of dollars, went into what's called stock buybacks, share buybacks. And what that means is a company goes out into the open market and buys back its own shares. That artificially boosts the stock price of a company. These companies also paid back a lot of dividend payments to investors. All this stuff is great for the top 20% of the population that owns 80% of the stocks. But it does not change the story on Main Street. It doesn't actually change what's happening in companies. It doesn't create jobs. It doesn't, make them, their growth trajectories for the longer term really change. So in some ways, it's a kind of an artificial, genetically modified sort of a boost to the market.
A GMO boost to the market.
It's a GMO, yeah.
I remember talking to you last year. Your book is really about the financialization of the economy. These, I guess, are the takers or the winners. But you also said when you look at the financial sector where a quarter of the profits are, it's only 4% of the jobs. So I guess the question is, it's the question to the president, to his administration, to the people who are going to be part of his more business economic part of the administration, which is how then do you create jobs in this economy?
Well, and that is the big question. And you know, I think, frankly, not just this president, but, you know, all the candidates in the 2016 election were not being totally frank with the American people about how difficult it's going to be to create jobs. You know, if you just look, again, stepping back, let's look at what economic growth really is. It's two things. It's the demographics of a country, how many people are in the country of working population, and how productive they are. So it's demographics plus productivity. If you look at those two things in the U.S., demographics have been declining for some time. You know, as countries get richer, women have fewer children. Something that tends to make demographics better is immigration. Yeah. But under this president, you know, that's becoming a big issue. Meanwhile, productivity, the amount of work you can get out of a single worker, has been flat for many years. You know, I think all of us just anecdotally feel like we're working very hard. White collar overtime has never been as high as it is now. In lieu of any kind of major technological shift that allows workers to become more productive, you're not going to see some kind of huge uptick in GDP growth. That's kind of the basic math. Now, there are things that the president could do to increase productivity, but those are not the things he's talking about. You know, I mean, things like worker training, you know, really encouraging companies to make investments in the things that help Main Street rather than Wall Street.
I was reading that 1 in 7 men ages 25 to 54, of course, the prime earning years, is not working. 1 in 7 men that age is not working. That's a very worrisome statistic.
It's such a worrisome statistic. And I tell you, one of the things I really worry about is the sort of populism that we saw in this last election cycle that brought President Trump to office was fueled in both fueled by many things, but it was fueled in part by a sense amongst a lot of people, in particularly in the white working class and men, you know, working class men feeling like their opportunities for advancement are just not there. And again, the meta trends in the economy are only going to fuel that feeling. So if you look at the number one category for men with a high school degree or less in this country, it's driver. Well, guess what? In the next
driver,
years,
like
driver.
A car driver,
like
Uber driver.
That's right. Uber driver, delivery person, people that drive supply trucks across the country. Those jobs are going away. Automated cars are coming. And in the next 5 years, they're going to replace a huge amount of those workers. So these are really big picture things that require huge strategic thought. And I don't see any of that coming out of this administration, frankly.
Well, as you say, and it's obviously clear, and candidate Trump certainly targeted immigrants, saying that they were part of the reason that people were losing jobs and the economy wasn't growing the way that it was.
Yeah, that's just false.
As false. Well, let me just ask you a quick question, and then we can go from there. But is it really more about technology than it is about immigrants?
Well, I think that technology and tech-related job displacement is sort of the new globalization, right? So if you, again, step back, think about what has really changed in the job situation in the last 40 years. It's globalization. It's the fact that companies could outsource jobs to wherever they were cheapest. That is what has cost Americans many of their jobs. Now, I'm not saying that globalization is a bad thing. If you look at it at a world level, it's lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. It's done a lot for a lot of people in America as well. But there have been losers from that situation, and we haven't buffered those losers. Looking forward, a tech-related job displacement is going to affect, in the next 5 years or so, it's going to affect about 60% of the American workforce. As a matter of fact, McKinsey came out with an interesting study recently looking at how artificial intelligence, software, robots are going to change jobs for the majority of Americans. And what they found was that 60% of the U.S. workforce would see 30% of the tasks that they do replaced by one of those technologies. Now, that's not saying that 60% of people are going to lose their jobs, but a lot of us are going to lose a chunk of the work that we are doing to new technologies. And that is going to require big, big picture adjustments that will mean we've got to have some public strategy. We've got to have private-public sector partnerships to help people transition in an incredibly tumultuous time. That's what's happening. And then if I can just add one more thing on the immigration point, the research is very clear on this. At a net level, when you net everything out, immigrants are an economic benefit to society, okay? I mean, immigrants are people, and I have to tell you, I'm a little biased. My father was an immigrant. My mother's parents were immigrants. Immigrants are people that come at both the high level and the lower levels and add benefits. You know, they are entrepreneurial. They are doing, many of them have started some of the top companies in this country. You know, I'm giving you support here, but the research shows that at that level, immigration is a benefit. And as a matter of fact, it is one of the key reasons that America has always had a slightly higher trend growth rate than Europe, because it does have more migration.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Rana Faruhar. She's business columnist at Time Magazine, also CNN's global economic analyst, and again wrote a book called Makers and Takers, came out last year, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Much of what she writes in her book is still true today. And we are talking about the economy, certainly the economy. It's only a couple of weeks into the Trump administration, but we're getting a feel for the lay of the land, talking about the potential impact on workers, on employers, and on the economy in general, and certainly on finance. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We were talking about small business at the very top of the hour. Let me get Wade from Northeast Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Wade. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a small business in Philadelphia. I'm very small, and I'm a manufacturer. And what I've seemed to see over the course of years is it all comes down to efficiencies in distribution for not only manufacturers, but service providers, anything. And, you know, I look at something like the development of Amazon and the efficiencies of distribution that is created there, but it also seems to create a lot of limitations and or the capitalization of distribution networks that you either go with the program or you're kind of, to use the expression, screwed. Because, and that also limits what kind of products and services that are available in the market. And
absolutely.
I just wondered what your guest has to say about that.
Well, wait, it sounds like Rana is raring to go. Rana, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's actually an excellent point. And I think we may be at a tipping point there. I mean, I think, Wade, what you're talking about is the fact that it's almost the, I mean, you mentioned Amazon, but it's sort of the Walmart effect, too. When you've got really big players, oftentimes monopoly players in the market, yes, you get efficiencies in distribution, but you also get limitations, the amount of products you get. I mean, if you look, I'll talk about Walmart because I think it's a little easier for people to kind of visualize. You walk into Walmart, you get cheap prices, but you also get a lot fewer products than you would at, say, a number of other local grocery stores, for example. That's how economies of scale have worked. But I actually think, and you would know better since you're on the ground with this, but I think that we're at a tipping point where, for starters, consumers, if you just look at consumer trends, they want products more quickly. They want a greater variety of products. If you look at retail shopping trends, people do want to walk into a store now, for example, and they're not going to shop in bulk two times a year. They want to go in every, 3 weeks and see something new in stores. That actually argues for more localized supply chains. And I do know a lot of companies are starting to experiment with that. That said, this is like turning the Titanic, right? You know, it's 40 years of globalization that have led to the outsourcing of supply chains, to these efficiency gains you're talking about. And they haven't worked so well for small business. It's interesting. My father actually recently, he started and recently sold a small manufacturing business in Indiana. And so I can really relate to what you're saying.
Oh, wait, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Rana, let me put something else on the table for discussion. And as we know, President Trump has, and even candidate Trump, either called out companies, individual companies, or kind of gave them the spotlight for things they were doing that he approved of. Nordstrom, of course, the sort of most obvious, glaring example of calling out a company because they decided, for sounds like their own business reasons, to drop his daughter's clothing line. What is the impact of something like that? It seems fairly unprecedented for a president to be talking this way about specific businesses.
Yeah, it's totally unprecedented. I mean, it reflects several things. For starters, it reflects the fact that this president is a businessman. Yeah, you know, not only is he a businessman, but if you look at his cabinet, his group of advisors, there is exponentially more total years of business experience and sort of business focus than there was in the previous administration, for example, about 85 years, in the Trump administration versus 5 years for the Obama team. So that's a big shift. But, this is also, frankly, about a president that's firing from the hip a little bit. I mean, the idea of having a strategy that would affect certain industries and companies is one thing. The idea of focusing in tweets about particular companies is something that I think, when I talk to business leaders, makes them very nervous. I was actually speaking to a VP at a major Fortune 500 company yesterday who's sort of on the right side of the administration right now, but he was saying, we don't know. We could be in the crosshairs tomorrow. It makes people feel uncertain, and uncertainty is not good for the economy.
Does it also silence people that might be under different circumstances more critical of what a president is doing or what this president is doing?
I think there's no doubt about that. Absolutely.
Let me get, looks like Anne Marie from New Hope to join us. Anne Marie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say Obamacare has reduced the cost of covering my workers. Migrants were the skilled people that I needed to start my business 25 years ago. And putting a tax on the imports that we then do finish work on will probably do my company in.
Will do your company in, really?
Yeah, for real. There's only so much you can raise. Prices.
That's for
I
sure.
I hear you.
No, that's for sure. I just
go ahead,
just to chime in on what you're on the caller. you know, that is statistically true. There are a number of companies that rely on imports that, if this tax were to go through, would see their profits, their own corporate profits, cut by 100% or as much as 200%. So it's no joke that this ruling, this legislation could drive a lot of people out of business, no question.
Anne-Marie, I my fingers are crossed. Hopefully your business will prevail. And thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Bye.
Ron, I was thinking of something I heard yesterday on NPR, and this was about NAFTA. And, of course, with a lot of these trade deals, there are, quote, winners and losers. But it was a cattle farmer. Apparently the cattle industry sends a lot of their meat to Mexico, and his concerns that if the rules were somehow changed under NAFTA, that would really be a big hit for the cattle industry. I guess it just sort of underscores just how complicated these trade deals are and how interconnected the world is.
Oh, for sure. I mean, if you think about cattle, interesting, it's a simple, easy to understand example. I mean, most businesses are dealing with supply chains that are even more complex. You know, if you just think about an airplane, let's say the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, that is an airplane in which parts are made in over 100 different countries. Mm-hmm. Think about what an import tax on every single product that's coming in would do to that airliner. It would literally never get off the ground, you know. It is very complex, and it's, you know, this is something that, you know, you hear the headlines of, oh, certain manufacturers are thrilled because it's going to help them. They can export, and their competitors who are importing might be taxed. Not so easy. It's, you know, the implications could be huge.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Rana Farooqar, business columnist at Time Magazine, CNN's global economic analyst, and we've got Shannon Coulter waiting in the wings, co-founder of Grab Your Wallet, a campaign encouraging consumers to boycott retailers that sell Trump-branded goods. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we've been talking about doing business under the Trump administration. And again, Rana Farooqar staying with us for the rest of the hour. Joining us now is Shannon Coulter, co-founder of Grab Your Wallet. That's a boycott campaign against Trump-branded products, something that came into being on October 11th, 2016. And Shannon Coulter, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
So what was the response, or what was the impetus for creating Grab Your Wallet?
Yeah, it was during the election, and I had just been on Nordstrom's site late one night doing some online shopping, as I often used to do. And I started just to feel some ambivalence about the fact that one of my favorite companies was doing business with the Trump family. You know, at the time, Ivanka was on the campaign trail hot and heavy for Donald and was marketing her products directly from the campaign trail. So I just felt ambivalent about one of my favorite companies profiting from a campaign that I considered to be pretty hateful.
And was it also in response to the hot mic moment that we all remember?
It was. This was all in the wake of the Trump tapes, so it was very much born of that. And Grab Your Wallet is a reference to the remarks that we all heard Donald make on the hot mic remarks, and also a reference to women's epic consumer power. You know, we drive between 70 to 80% of all consumer purchases. So I knew that if I could harness that, we could really do something.
Well, it's been a couple of months. We know that Nordstrom has dropped Ivanka Trump's brand. Do you think that's because of your boycott campaign?
Well, I think ultimately I attribute Ivanka's poor sales performance right now to her own actions. You know, she campaigned for a guy who questioned the nationality of the president for 5 years, who makes fun of disabled people. I think that ultimately what we're seeing with Ivanka's brand is a response to her own actions, but I certainly don't think the boycott helped.
And do you want to put the Trumps out of business?
Nope, that's not the goal. The goal isn't to put anybody out of business or to hurt anybody's brand. The goal is just to shop with a clear conscience and no bad memories. For a lot of women, seeing the name Trump in the retail environment when they're trying to shop, which is something women do often when they want to relax, is actually a pretty jarring thing.
Let me get you in on the conversation. Rana, what do you make of this campaign?
Oh, boy, I completely agree with that. And I think that this is absolutely the right kind of grassroots response. You know, consumers have a tremendous amount of power. Female consumers absolutely control the purse strings of the country. And in fact, globally, they have more spending power and will have the largest chunk of spending power going forward. So it's a very powerful way, you know, beyond just voting, that people can express their opinions about what's happening.
I mean, it's so interesting. Not the first time to you, Shannon, and to you, Ron, about buying as a political act. I remember the grape boycotts of, you know, back in the 60s and 70s when boycotting things was a way of making a statement about the treatment of workers. Shannon, how I know, and you have a website, and there are a lot of companies on your list there. How do you know if it's working, if it's successful? What are your measurements?
Well, one thing we know is that the hashtag, the Grab Your Wallet hashtag, has been seen over 700 million times on Twitter alone, which is, you know, I'm a career digital marketer, and I've never seen numbers like that. And the website gets upwards of 30,000 unique visits per hour. So we certainly know that there's at least a lot of interest around this.
And does it also include the Trump resorts and golf courses, things like that?
Yeah, there are three categories of companies on the boycott list. One category are retailers that do business with the Trump family. They sell Trump family products, and that includes Donald's clothes, Ivanka's clothes, and also a Trump home line. And then there are companies where either the C-suite or board members help to fundraise for Donald Trump or fundraised for a Trump super PAC or PAC.
Wow.
And then there are the Celebrity Apprentice advertisers because Donald Trump is still a paid executive producer of that program. Now, one thing I should add with that is that what's emerged over time as those companies have actually reached out directly to me is that NBC might not have been completely transparent with them about Donald Trump's continued involvement in the show at the time that they were courting advertisers.
So how long is your list?
Well, we've had 18 companies dropped from the list since we began in October, but there are still over 50 companies on the list.
Over 50 companies. And I also know that there's some kind of a boycott of your boycott. Do you want to, have you had to deal with that?
Well, I mean, one thing that I would really like to see is us get to a place where we support one another's Supreme Court upheld rights, whether we agree with our fellow citizens or not. So I support my fellow citizens' right to boycott. I think it's an important form of peaceful protest in this country, and I would never qualify another boycott as bullying, as some have mine, for instance. You know, I didn't agree with the Christian community's boycott of Target over its bathroom policies. This was a while back, but I completely support their right to do that. That's their choice in a free market.
Have you ever done anything like this before?
No, I've been a pretty straight-ahead career girl for my whole adult life, so this is brand new for me.
So this is your new career?
Possibly. There's discussion about evolving this into a consumer resource of some kind that helps consumers navigate the marketplace and also continue to flex their consumer power in favor of a more respectful and inclusive society. And I should add, that is the goal here. This isn't a partisan movement. This isn't about Democrats versus Republicans at all. This is about common human decency and respect. There's a significant contingent, for instance, of LDS Mormon people as a part of this movement, and many of them are registered Republicans. And I take that as a sign of a great many people just wanting to move our society toward a more respectful and inclusive place.
Well, Shannon, I know you're a busy girl, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
And that's Shannon Coulter, co-founder of Grab Your Wallet, a boycott campaign against Trump-branded products. And again, Rana Farouhar from Time Magazine and CNN staying with us for the rest of the hour, talking about doing business under the Trump administration, under Trumponomics. And again, you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Very interesting, Rana, to hear from Shannon and to hear, I guess, this passionate grassroots movement that we see either in demonstrations across the country or certainly in what she's doing with her Grab Your Wallet campaign.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it strikes me that in some ways, economic activism is in some ways the perfect response to the current political moment that we're in. You know, we have a businessman president The idea of sending a message with your wallet seems particularly appropriate. It's funny, too, because it puts me in mind of how companies themselves are actually engaging in corporate diplomacy at the moment. You know, in lieu of governments really being able to act in a seamless way these days, a lot of companies are getting more involved in the education space and the health space, you know, some of it in controversial ways, but also some of it in ways that could potentially be helpful. You know, there are companies, tech companies, that are starting new kinds of schools. IBM has a kind of a corporate Peace Corps that it's running, and it's just interesting. It's hard to know. And some I have mixed feelings about all this, because in some ways it's an admission that the public space is so beleaguered at the moment that corporations are kind of moving further into areas that were once the purvey of the public sector. But on the other hand, I like the idea of corporate resources, money, and attention going to, you know, things that we all need to focus on.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got Kia. Kia calling us from Lansdale. Kia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you? I'm a first-time caller.
Oh, good for you. Thanks,
listener.
Kia.
All right, thank you. Miss Farouche, is that your last name?
Farouhar,
yes.
Yes.
Farouhar, okay, I'm sorry, Farouhar. My question is, it's about African Americans. We have been disproportionately affected by the economy for basically hundreds of years. And I just want to know is what can we do to better become a part of the economy, because
sure,
there's all these statistics about how we for years don't get paid well, but it seems like we're always the ones ignored by Democrats and Republicans.
Well, Kia,
it's
such an important question.
Yeah,
no, thank you, Kia, for calling in. And Rana, go ahead.
So I have 2 points to make on that. First of all, totally agree. And statistically, the caller is right. If you look at who suffered the most following the 2008 financial crisis and Great Recession, it was absolutely minorities and particularly African Americans. You know, just post 2008, here's a statistic that I find shocking, saddening, and sobering. The average liquid wealth for an African American family was under
$200.
Average liquid wealth for an African American family post financial crisis under $200. You know, many thousands for white families. A lot of that has to do with the fact that, like most middle class and working Americans, African Americans tend to keep the majority of their wealth in their homes. Well, if you look at what asset class got hammered in the 2008 financial crisis, it was, of course, housing. Now, when you look at the response to the crisis, it was essentially because government was gridlocked and we couldn't really fix housing and we couldn't get through a real fiscal plan to boost Main Street, you had a response on the part of the Fed and central banks, which, you know, they were the last guys standing and trying to do what they could, but all they could do was bolster the stock market. Well, that disproportionately helps white people, because guess what? White people own a greater percentage of stocks than African Americans do. All of this it really expresses just the complication and the kind of inherent racism, frankly, in the economy. So understanding that is point number one. I also think one real issue that we should all be focusing on is the way in which technology and in particular big data is going to be used going forward to enable access to credit. This is both a huge challenge and a huge opportunity, because if you look at the way credit gets proportioned right now, whites have a lot of advantages just in terms of getting credit, access to credit at banks, credit cards. There's a possibility now with better data points that African Americans could benefit from this, but there's also a big opportunity for the algorithms to create more racism.
Oh, goodness.
And I think that this is really something that we need to focus on. And, you know, there are people in Washington that I know that are really tuned into this issue.
Kia, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and don't be shy, call us again. Let me read a comment from David, and this goes back to the boycott issue. He says boycotts hurt low-income workers who work at stores like Macy's. You think that's true, Rana?
You know, I'm sure on a company by company, on a store by store basis, you can probably make that case. But I think if you look overall, that's a minor part of what's happening in the economy. And retail jobs have been diminishing for some time for all kinds of reasons, mainly technology. You know, you look at a company like Amazon has by far greater effect on workers at Macy's than any boycott. So I guess I see that as being a small part of this overall issue.
Let me get Jean from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Jean. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'd like to get the opinion of your guests regarding H-1B visas.
Yes.
These are visas that are granted to foreign workers who have skills in computer technology, computer development. And over the past 10 years, tens of thousands of Americans have been laid off and often required to train their replacements, who are flown in by big companies, corporations based in India typically, train their replacements and then are laid off.
Did that happen to you?
President Trump has said he would cut back on the number of visas granted to foreign workers working for foreign corporations. And I'd like your host to address the fact that highly skilled people, not people making socks or shucking corn, are now being driven to unemployment.
Gene, just a quick question. Did that happen to you?
No, I left that field 15 years ago because I could see what was going down, and I moved on to better things.
Okay, fair enough. Rana, go ahead.
Interesting. So you're raising a hugely important point. Yeah, this absolutely has happened. I have heard many stories of people having to train their cheaper replacements. I mean, for starters, how degrading and dispiriting. But I think that what this reflects is this larger process of how economic globalization has really moved ahead over the last 40 years of political globalization. So you have companies that can kind of do whatever they want. They can put jobs wherever they want. They can put capital wherever they want. But, you know, the governments still work at a national level. People still live at a national and regional and local level and have to deal with these problems. I want to step back and say, I understand, as much as I have issues with a lot of the policies of this current administration, I understand the sentiment of why we have a populist in office today, because a lot of people feel that there's a two-tiered system where wealthy companies and wealthy individuals are benefiting from the current system, and people, you know, working people on the ground, like, you know, most of us that get our money in a paycheck every couple of weeks, are not. And I think that that's what your listener is hitting on. And there are not simple answers to this question, but I think acknowledging that this is happening, acknowledging both that people in America are being displaced by cheaper foreign labor, but also that immigrants that come to this country with tech degrees create a lot of jobs. These are both truths, and we have to integrate this in a worldview and develop policies to go from there.
Gene, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. About a minute, Rana, before we have to say goodbye to you. So how soon can we say that we are living under a Trump economy when we get job figures and consumer confidence numbers? How long does that take?
I'm sorry, can you rephrase the question? You're asking how long?
Well, you know, we talk about an Obama economy,
yeah,
a Trump economy, a Bush,
yeah,
a Reagan.
Yeah,
what is it? How long does that take before you really begin to feel the effects, or is that just
up for
grabs?
I think we're going to, the rubber is going to hit the road. My prediction is the rubber will hit the road in what the Trump economy really is in about 18 months to 2 years. And the reason I say that is I think that's how long it will take to get through potentially a tax cut and a repatriation. Once people see, let's assume that that happens and you get a lot of foreign money from U.S. companies coming back, it goes into the stock market, the stock market goes up, but maybe you don't see those investments on Main Street, then what happens? Do you get a correction in the markets? I would guess so, because I think Wall Street is disconnected from Main Street. At what point do people start to think, I'm not getting what I was promised, and how does that affect the midterm elections and the makeup of Congress? I think that that's what we should be watching for.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. I always learn a lot talking to you, Rana. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that's Rana Farrukhar, business columnist at Time Magazine, CNN's global economic analyst, author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.